For sure. Every conviction my adult life was built on. And if this was a lie, just another performance, a manipulation, then why did it feel like the truth? You don't have to believe me, Will said. You don't even have to help me. But there's a guy out there killing young women again, and he's a few more to go. Forget about what that means for me. Think about what it means for him, out there. You could catch him. Stop him. You can too, right now. I slid the photograph across the table to him. Do you know this man? Will said nothing, waiting. Fine, I said. I'll look into that website for you, but I'm not promising anything. It might not even exist. Which was exactly what I planned on telling him, should there come a time when I had to tell him anything. Right now, I was planning on never seeing him ever again. Thank you, Will said, relieved. Thank you. He picked up the closest print to him, the best one, studied it for what felt like an age. Then he set it aside and repeated the process with the photo underneath, and so on through the pile. The seconds ticked by. He looks familiar, Will said, but I can't remember from where. A pause. Maybe St. John's? Without thinking, I said, I think it is. He raised an eyebrow. What? Shit. Too late to take it back now. He looks familiar to me, too. Will looked at me for a long moment. But I don't know from where either, I added. I just think if I think he looks familiar, and you think so too, then it has to be St. John's, right? Will looked down at the image again. Could be someone we saw around, he said. On nights out or something. I don't think he was in my class. Or yours. We'd remember him then, wouldn't we? Well, it's been 10 years. A beat passed. Ali, Will said then. Do you still have the brick? The brick? I'd lugged a digital camera around campus that first year, producing it at opportune moments with a misplaced smugness. Like it was the first iPhone and I was Steve Jobs. It was a cumbersome thing, bigger than the kind that took film, and had interchangeable lenses. We'd nicknamed it the brick. I hadn't thought of it in years. Cutting-edge technology, that was, Will said. For about 5 minutes, and long before I got it. Where did you get it? My dad won it in a raffle at work, and then gave it to me for Christmas. Problem was, the raffle and that Christmas were like 2 years apart. He'd stuck it in a drawer and forgotten about it. By the time I was using it, it was practically obsolete, and 3 times the size of everyone else's. That's right, Will said. Yeah, I remember now. We both fell into our memories for a moment. I doubt it, I said. It surely got thrown out. What about the photos you took with it? What about them? You must have had hundreds, and you had them in albums, with all the names and dates and stuff. Do you still have all those? Will pointed at the pictures on the tabletop. Ali, this guy, he could be in one of them.
Amy was supposed to work until 9 and then go straight from the cafe to meet her friends at a bar on Dawson Street. This is her usual Sunday night routine. But now it's not even 10 and she's come home, angry about something, stomping around and slamming things. She dumps a book bag onto the floor of her bedroom and something sparkly and black falls out of it, followed by one high heel, the clothes she'd brought with her to change into after work. Her plans have changed, which means his have too. He waits to see what she does next. She spends some time in the kitchen. He's seen it. All the lights are on in there. Tonight, the remnants of a pizza delivery sit on the table amid numerous empty bottles, cans, and plastic cups. The state of the kitchen, he can only assume, is what has apparently annoyed Amy even more. She comes back into the bedroom and starts picking through things on the floor. Clothes, socks, the cables of various hairstyling instruments, while swearing under her breath. while he holds his. Amy plugs her phone charger from the detritus and shoves it into a wall socket, connects her phone, throws it on the bed to charge. Thud. Back into the kitchen, switching the light off in the bedroom as she goes through the door. It sounds like she's clearing things away while the kettle boils, crockery clattering, a rush of water into the sink, the crinkling of a plastic refuse sack, cupboard doors open and close. Amy boils the kettle for a second time, and then there's the sound of tea making, the tinkling of a small spoon stirring the contents of a cup. The microwave comes on, runs for a half minute or so. An odd, greasy smell fills the air. Dinner must be reheated pizza. Click. The light goes off in the kitchen. Click. Her bedroom burns with brightness again. The shade from her ceiling light is missing, and that's what casts such a harsh light. The bare bulb. Amy roots around in various places. Among the cosmetics on the dressing table, in the drawer underneath it, in a toiletry bag that was upturned at the end of the bed. Then she undresses. She leaves the items where they fall, at her feet. She stands naked for a moment, turning this way and that, studying her body in a mirror he can't see. Then she takes the toweling robe that's hanging off the back of her door, it's purple and covered in orange makeup stains, and leaves the bedroom again. Down the hall, the door to the shared bathroom opens and closes. For the next 10 minutes or so, the shower runs. It's too short a window for him. He can't risk it. But a shower, that's promising. She might be heading back out again, like he first thought. But when Amy returns, she changes into what, for her, seems to constitute pajamas. A pair of shorts with a butterfly pattern on them and a t-shirt flecked with bleach stains. Then she turns off the light and crawls into bed. It's so cheap and poorly constructed, it sags beneath Amy's weight, which isn't much, and the horizontal wooden slats shift and creak as she settles into a position. It is completely dark, then it is dimly blue. The light is from the phone, he realizes. Her phone. Amy has a new something. A message of some sort. But she makes no move to get up and see what it says, even though she has only just got into bed and has to still be awake. Instead, she rolls over. Soon the room falls completely dark again. Sometime later, her breathing settles into a regular pattern. Sometime after that, she starts to lightly snore. He waits another half an hour, just to be safe, before he crawls, slowly and stealthily, out from under her bed.
Allison, now. The next morning I awoke with a start, as if disturbed by a noise. I sat up and surveyed the room, watching as the darkness relented, as forms took shape and slowly emerged from the black. There was nothing unexpected among them. Whatever woke me must have been in my dream. I flopped back down and tried to go back to sleep. Ding! My phone was sitting on one of the bedside tables, its screen glowing. Sal had sent me a string of texts. Some late last night, one just now. They were all along a similar theme. If I didn't call her soon, she was calling the police. Knowing Sal, she was only half joking. I'd never told Sal about Will. Or Liz. When I first met her, it was much too soon. Too raw. I still hadn't made sense of it myself. Then there never seemed to be a right time. Now it felt like it was too late. I didn't know how she'd react to the news that I'd been keeping a secret from her as long as we'd known each other, and that I'd had to lie to her in order to do that. Besides, I didn't want to tell her. I didn't want her to know. Sal had a husband now. I couldn't ask her to keep things from him, so telling Sal would be telling Dirk, potentially. And as much as I liked Dirk, I couldn't trust him not to tell someone else. It unnerved me even to imagine it, but I could. All this in my other life. Whispers spreading like an infectious disease. Other members of the EU's googling old news stories. looking up at our next get-together to catch someone looking at me, and knowing by the way their face would start to colour that they'd been sitting there thinking, how could she have really not known? How could she? But I had to tell Sal something. I couldn't keep up the pretense of period pain for 3 days in a row. So I sent her a text saying something had come up, that everyone was all right, but I'd had to travel to Dublin to see my parents on very short notice. I said she wasn't to worry and that I'd call her later today to explain all. I hoped that by then I'd have come up with something. There was a thin gap between the curtains, and for the next hour I watched the sky brighten from a dull grey to a bright blue. Then I got up and pulled the curtains back for the full view. This stretch of the canal could be incredibly picturesque, especially on a cold spring morning that came with clear skies and a chilly sun like this one. The water was almost level with the road. There was nothing between it and the paths on the bank except for some muddy grass, a negligible incline, and here and there, clusters of thick, waist-high reeds. Over the tops of the trees, I could see the boxy, boring office blocks that lined the canal on the opposite side. The waters of the canal were so still, the surface looked like glass. You could walk right in. Fall right in, if you were drunk and it was dark. There were some obstacles in other parts of it. You might meet a low wall or a sporadic stretch of iron railings. But here, and for the most part, there were no barriers at all. When Liz and I had been searching for somewhere to live during those panicked few days before Rumina Halls opened up, my mother had cited this as reason enough not to live anywhere near here. She was convinced she'd be getting a call from the guards to say I'd been pulled out of it in the early hours of a Sunday morning after drunkenly falling in. But as it turned out, it hadn't been me. Or an accident. I showered, dried my hair, and sent an email to SunCamp HR, explaining that I had a family emergency and wouldn't be in today or, in all likelihood, tomorrow either. I promised to keep them updated. For a second I thought about what would go on in my absence, what wouldn't get done, the answers that would be delayed. But then I pushed those thoughts away. I couldn't even begin to worry about work now. In the scheme of things, it just didn't matter. I rifled through my case looking for something clean, but nothing was. I couldn't face putting back on anything I'd worn yesterday, or the clothes I'd travelled in the day before. I settled for my pyjama top, which, if you didn't study it too closely, might pass as a grey t-shirt. I wondered if there was anything left of mine at my parents' house that I could fit into. My parents. At the thought of seeing them here in Dublin, the cup of instant coffee I'd assembled from the amenities tray started to work its way back up my throat. We didn't talk about Will, ever. In our family, I'd gone to secondary school and done my leaving cert, and then gone to college in Den Haag. It was as if the year in between had been wiped from our collective memories, and as if the girl I'd been best friends with my first day at primary school, the girl who had featured in every obsessive phase, tap dancing, Backstreet Boys, the OC, and every milestone, who spent more time at our house than anyone outside our immediate family, had merely moved away somewhere. We didn't talk about her either. But now I was here, back in Dublin, because the Gardaí had brought me back to talk to Will, and I'd be knocking on Mam and Dad's door in the hope that somewhere in their garage was a picture from 10 years ago that, unbeknownst to me at the time, had captured a man who, maybe, was out there killing young women right now in exactly the same way Will had killed Liz and 4 other innocent girls. The subject could hardly be avoided under such circumstances. We were good with the whole denial thing, but we weren't that good. In the car on the drive back to my hotel last night, I'd given Malone the highlights of what Will had said, that he thought the CCTV man looked familiar, and suspected he'd crossed paths with him during his St. John's days. I'd also told him about Will's idea of checking the photos, and we'd arranged that Malone would collect me from the hotel at 11 this morning and drive me out to my parents' house. I also told him that I thought I'd seen the man somewhere, and that just that morning I'd seen a similar man wearing a red baseball cap sitting on the opposite bank of the canal, looking up at the hotel. I stressed that I couldn't make out much about him from that distance, and that I was aware more than one man in Dublin City was likely to own a red baseball cap. But still, it felt like too much of a coincidence. Malone said he'd check the area security cameras to see if any of them had picked up this man, to see if we could determine if Benchman and CCTV man were one and the same. I really didn't want them to be. It would make my open hotel room door yesterday more than just a mechanical malfunction. I went back to the window. The scene outside had changed dramatically in the last half hour. Earlier, there'd been only a handful of people walking along the canal. Now there were herds of office workers hurrying past, while cyclists carefully navigated the clogged cycle lane, running parallel to the path. Nearly everyone was moving in the same direction, from my left to my right, i.e. from the nearest Lewis station to the tech companies in Grand Canal Dock. There were so many of them that the scene had an unnaturalness to it, as if they were all extras on a movie set, following directions. Dublin's rush hour presents the Truman Show. But crowds were good. A person could go unseen in them. And I desperately wanted to go outside and not be seen. Since Saturday afternoon, I'd spent my time in a car, a plane, another car, a psychiatric hospital, and holed up in this stuffy hotel room. I wasn't interested in strolling down memory lane, but I could do with a stroll in the fresh air. I believed Malone when he said that no one would recognize me, or even remember who I was. That so much time had passed, people barely remembered the victims anymore, let alone the killer's college girlfriend. Plus, now there was no point worrying that someone who knew my parents would see me and tell them I was here. There was nowhere in Ireland you could go where that wasn't a fear, because I was going to be telling them that myself in a few hours' time. So I went outside. The instant I felt the sun on my face, I felt like I'd made the right decision. There were a cluster of people, maybe four or five, right outside the hotel's entrance. I didn't turn to look at them, but they weren't talking to each other and I smelled smoke, so I presumed it was just the breakfast time rush in the designated smoking area. Instead, I turned right towards St. John's, but with a plan to turn off into Baggot Street Upper. There were plenty of cafes there. It was only a couple of minutes' walk away, and I'd be going in the same direction as the herd. If I spotted anyone who looked like the man in the red baseball cap, I could just duck in somewhere and call Malone. I figured that with so many people around, I'd be fine either way. I'd avoid going any further, any closer to St. John's. Turns out, I didn't even have to go as far as the turn onto Baggot Street. There was a coffee shop before the corner. I ordered a large latte and took it to one of the two tables just outside, grabbing one of the complimentary newspapers that had been piled on a corner inside, out with me. I didn't plan to read it. It was just going to be a prop more than anything. But just as I sat down, one of the headlines on the front page caught my eye. Gardaí arrange canal. I unfolded the paper, laid it flat on the table. Gardaí arrange canal killer date. Underneath the headline was a picture of me. Serial killer Will Hurley's former girlfriend, Alison Smith, 29, leaves a hotel on Messville Road yesterday, en route to a private meeting with him at the Central Psychiatric Hospital in Dundrum. Sources say this is related to the Garda investigation into the deaths of students Louise Farrington and Jennifer Madden earlier this year. For more, see page 2. I quickly folded the paper up again and turned it over. My hands were shaking. I hadn't noticed anyone outside the hotel yesterday morning. It had only taken seconds to walk from the door to Malone's car. But there must have been someone there, and with a camera. How did they know? How did they know I was there and where I was going? And where were those people now? I felt dizzy and sick. Someone had sat down at the other table. An older woman wearing brightly colored Nikes under her skirt suit. She'd got a paper too. She was reading it right now, looking at that front page. She looked up at the canal, then turned to look down the street. Yes, that hotel right there. Yes, that very one. Please don't look this way. I looked exactly as I did in that picture. I was even wearing the same black leather jacket. I had to go. I took my coffee and stepped onto the street, turned in the direction of the hotel, and a blonde woman was walking right towards me, looking straight at me, smiling. "Alison," she said warmly as if we knew each other. She turned and signaled at someone over her shoulder, and when I looked, I saw a man with an expensive-looking camera hurrying to catch up with her. Do you have a minute to chat? I put my head down, kept going. I had to get to the hotel. How is Will? She stepped right in front of me, blocking my way. The path was busy with pedestrians, and some of them were starting to turn and look. What does he know that could help the Gardaí? I didn't know what to do now. I had my phone and I could call Malone, but what did I do until he got here? I stepped around her, started forward again. But then I saw, further up the street, what was outside the hotel. Two men, chatting to each other with cameras slung over their shoulders, and just pulling into the car park, a satellite truck with a news station's logo stenciled on the side. Plus, as every second passed, someone else turned to look. I don't, as a rule, run. My legs have no muscle memory of exactly how to, and burn ferociously whenever I must, like when the train is leaving in 30 seconds and I'm still at the turnstiles, and running down a busy footpath filled with pedestrians while holding a coffee is the type of activity that draws the very kind of attention I was trying to avoid. But what choice did I have? I'm not saying it was the best idea. It wasn't an idea, not really. I didn't think about it at all. I just did it. I turned in the opposite direction and ran. Alison, now. I'd never been to my parents' house in Bray, but I'd seen pictures. It was a neat, two-story terraced house, tucked away on a quiet street a couple of blocks from the seafront, painted pale blue and almost completely obscured by the gnarled branches of an old oak tree in the front garden. My mother had explained that they spent most of their time in the conservatory-style extension to the rear, so the shadow of the tree across the front of the house didn't bother them, and offered some privacy to boot. Standing underneath the branches of that tree now, halfway up my parents' garden path, I felt sweaty and shivery. Back in the city centre, I'd run for about a block before turning around to check that no one was following me. No one was. But I couldn't go back to the hotel, and I didn't want to have to wait on the street for Malone to come get me. So I kept going, all the way to the nearest start station, where I'd boarded a southbound commuter train, put my head down, and put my parents' address into Google Maps. I'd only looked up once, in response to the group of German tourists in the seats opposite the aisle to me, murmuring, "Ah," as the full sweep of Killiney Bay suddenly came into view below us, almost a rival for the French Riviera in sunny weather like this. Almost. Jesus Christ! The front door of the house had opened, and my mother was coming towards me now, hurrying down the uneven concrete slabs that formed the path, one hand holding a mobile phone to her ear and the other waving at me frantically. The cashmere cardigan she was wearing floated like a cape behind her. "She's here, Jackie, at the gate." "Oh, now." To me. "Alison, what in the name of..." Back into the phone. "I don't know, I'll find out. Yeah, yeah. Look, I'll call you back, okay? I'll call you back." To me again. "What in the name of God are you doing here? What's going on? How did you get here? Why didn't you call us?" I was regretting this already. "Hi, ma'am," I said. The phone slipped into a pocket. She grabbed both my hands with hers. "Jackie just rang to say she saw you on the front of one of the papers, and then she says to me, 'No, you don't understand, she's here in Dublin.' And I said, 'Ma'am,' I said, 'take a breath, please. I just want to know what's going on, Alison. Why didn't you tell us you were coming to Dublin? Where did they get that picture of you? Did you know you were going to be on it?' "Let's go inside." The street seemed deserted, but this could be a valley of squinting windows. "Come on." As my mother walked ahead of me, muttering the names of Catholic saints under her breath, I had a moment to take her in. She looked well, wearing a neat, tailored pair of wool trousers and a silk shirt with a bright pattern. The thin cardigan she was wearing over it looked expensive, designed more for style than for warmth. Her mousy brown hair was no longer streaked grey, but highlighted with flattering white blonde tones, and she was wearing costume jewellery, a new habit as far as I knew. "You're all dressed up," I said. "Hardly," my mother made a scoffing noise. I was just going to Dunleary for a look around the shops before Jackie called me and nearly gave me a stroke. And then you immediately ran outside like a crazy person. At the threshold, my mother turned around to make a face at me. Don't be silly. I was looking out the window when I saw you coming in the gate. Inside the house, I was a bit taken aback. Pristine checkered tiles in the hall. A glimpse of a cozy living room that looked like a page torn from a Laura Ashley catalogue. Through a door into the sudden space and bright light of a mammoth extension that seemed to stretch out as far as the entire footprint of the original house, and then half as much again. A radio was playing traditional Irish music at low volume somewhere in the house. Our family home in Cork had been pokey and dark, a mishmash of furniture my parents had bought on impulse during sales. Previously, my mother's idea of decoration had been matching cushions that came free with a couch they'd picked in some hanger-sized furniture store off a motorway roundabout. "It's lovely," I said. "Did you do all this by yourself?" "Yes, yes," she said dismissively, waving a hand. "What's going on?" My mother was finally a bit calmer now, and I think really seeing me for the first time since I'd arrived. "Your hair," she said, peering at it. "Did you change it?" "No, I just didn't do it this morning." I hastily tucked a few strands behind my ears. "Here, give me your jacket." It was off before I realized I was wearing my pajama top underneath. "I had to pack quickly," I explained when I saw her frowning at it. "I didn't bring enough tops. Actually, are there any of my old clothes here? I could do with grabbing something." "Where's all your stuff? Your suitcase?" "Back at the hotel." "The hotel? But sure you can stay here." "No, I..." She wasn't going to like this, and I couldn't blame her. "The hotel where I've been staying, ma'am, since Saturday." Her face fell. "You've been here since Saturday?" I suggested we sit down. The extension was divided into three defined spaces. Kitchen, dining, an area with a TV and couches. I followed my mother to the dining table. She sat at one end of it. I sat beside her. There was a little pile of ceramic coasters sitting in the middle of it that I remembered her buying at a crafts market in Delft, and a half-drunk cup of tea. "Where's Dad?" I asked. "Is he here?" "Your father is somewhere between here and Killarney." She stood up again so she could get her phone out of her pocket. "I'll call him. He only left a couple of hours ago, and I think they're stopping for breakfast, so..." "Mom," I said, reaching out to take the phone off her. "Don't. There's no need." "Do you think he's going to want to play a round of golf when he sees your face on the front of all the papers? He's coming back anyway. We might as well save him the petrol." I rolled my eyes. "Can you just sit down?" Now she rolled her eyes, but did what I'd asked. "Look," I said, "this isn't a big deal. There's no need to freak out, but..." I gave her the highlights reel. Malone and Shaw knocking on my door. The new murders and me going to talk to Will. "Jesus," she said when I'd finished. "Ma'am, listen. This is all private, okay? You can't repeat any of it to anyone." "Jackie says it's all over the papers." "That doesn't mean you have to go around offering confirmations. There were reporters at the hotel this morning, and more photographers. If they find out I'm here..." I sighed. "Look, if anyone knocks on the door, or rings your phone, or puts a note through the letterbox, just ignore it, okay? Just ignore it." "I'm not an idiot, Alison. But you think you have to be polite. You don't." "Well, I can't not answer the door now, can I?"
I looked at her incredulously.
"What?" she said. "Ma'am, that's exactly my point." "But what if it's one of the neighbors? You shouldn't be talking to them either." "Alison," another eye roll. "In all fairness, I mean about this. Don't talk to anyone about it. Anyone at all. And since I know what you're like, that means not talking to anyone full stop. They'll all get on fine not knowing what color knickers I've on for the next few days."
My mother pulled at her shirt's collar, admonished. Then she said,
"I didn't tell that man anything."
There was a flicker of panic before I realized she was talking about back then. After Will had been arrested, but before he'd been formally charged, a reporter had doorstepped my mother at the house in Cork. The property was on a lonely country road just outside the city, and at first this reporter, a man, had pretended to be lost and looking for directions. Somehow he steered the conversation onto that awful business up in Dublin, and my mother inadvertently revealed, or rather confirmed, that she was a bit player in it. By the time he left, she'd told him that she and I were very close, that Will was a lovely boy, and that she was convinced this silly business was a misunderstanding that would all be sorted out very soon. "We stand by the canal killer," they went with on that one. Remember how back in the playground, some bullish girl would come up to you and say, "Angela knows you hate her," and you'd instantly get that sick feeling, the sudden descent of a cold, hard stone of dread into the pit of your stomach that would sit there until the lies, misunderstanding, rumour, whatever it was, could be corrected, until you'd found Angela and made it clear that that's not something you'd have ever, ever said. Well, times that by the readership of an Irish national newspaper. People you can't contact to clarify. And add your mother, the person responsible, dismissing your hot shame, telling you that you're being silly, that it doesn't matter. It'll all be forgotten in a few days, and anyway, who cares what people think? "You haven't talked to anyone already," I said. "Have you?" "Like who?" "Like your friend Jackie. How much does she know?" My mother muttered something under her breath. I asked her to repeat it. "I said she knows a lot more than I do." A pounding was starting at the front of my head. "You don't talk to us," my mother went on. "About this. You never have." Here it came then, approaching like a freight train while I lay helpless tied to the tracks. The conversation. The one that had been hanging over our heads for the last 10 years. Their visits to the Netherlands, our holidays abroad. They came with an unspoken agreement that there'd be a reprieve from the threat of this, and plenty of conversation topics, the sights, the food, how sullen that waiter was, to help us honour it. But there could be no reprieve here. Sitting at my mother's kitchen table in Dublin, I knew I was facing it head on, and I couldn't face it. Just the mere threat of it felt like walking through a hammering shower of sharp glass shards. "I don't want to talk about it, ma'am." "But you'll go see that boy in prison and have a grand old chat with him, will you?" "I was in there for all of 10 minutes. "You came back for those 10 minutes. You've said no any time we asked you to come back for us." "The Gardaí made me." "Oh, come off it, Alison. How could they make you? Surely that'd be illegal." I rolled my eyes, my 19-year-old self, a muscle memory waking up. "You know what I mean, ma'am." "Alison," she said, leaning her elbows on the table. "For the love of God, something awful happened to you, yes. Awful things happen all the time. People deal with them. People deal with a lot worse. They recover. They put it behind them. They move on. But you just ran off, ran away. And I understood that at the time. You were only 19. When you're that age, you've no perspective on things. You can't be expected to. You haven't been around long enough. So I'm sure it did feel like the end of the world to you. We let you go for that reason, because we understood that. But I thought that a few months down the line, or maybe after you'd finished your degree, you'd realise that what happened didn't quite warrant your reaction to it." I blinked at her. When I spoke again, it took some effort to keep my voice even. "Will murdered 5 girls, ma'am. One of whom was my best friend. And you're accusing me now of being melodramatic?" "That's not what I'm saying at all. You're taking me up wrong. You're making it easy to. You're making sure you do." My mother clasped her hands in front of her, set them on the table. "Look, love, I understood back then. I did. But not now, 10 years later. What are you holding on to all this for? We only do what works for us. What are you getting out of this?" "We only do what works for us." She hadn't come up with that one by herself, that was for sure. That was her daytime TV talk show habit rearing its ugly head. "I'm not holding on to anything," I said. "I'm fine. But you don't come home. Breda is my home. And then you come back for him. Not for him, ma'am. That's not what happened. And I don't hear anything about boyfriends or, you know, maybe getting married one of these days. Jesus Christ! I stood up and started making a loop around the table, just because I couldn't stay still anymore. Are you serious? Your big concern here is that I don't have a boyfriend. Not everyone wants the same things, ma'am. And guess what? It's not the fucking 50s. Language, Alison, please. My mother stood up too, to take her cup of tea into the kitchen and wash it out in the sink. My only concern always is you. I don't know whether or not you have what you want, because I don't know what you want. I don't know how you are or what you're thinking, or what kind of pain you might be in. I don't know anything at all because you don't tell me. You tell me about what happened at work and what you did last weekend and how much the carpet cleaning cost you, but you never tell me how you feel. Tears sprung to my eyes and I hated my body for betraying me. I swallowed them back. Oh, come on, I said. When did we ever talk about how I felt? I didn't even like Liz half the time. Did you know that? Did you? What's that supposed to mean? Alison, if you think I didn't see what that girl was really like, how she treated you, I guess I must have blanked out all our cozy mother-daughter fireside chats about it. My mother swung around to face me. The problem with you, Alison, is that you had your teenage years too late. You were no trouble to us at all until you went off to college. You decided to have all your adolescent angst then, but then Will happened and you got stuck there. You've never moved past this thing that happened then, so you don't let yourself get past that age. You've never given yourself a proper chance to. She paused. And I don't just mean with me, love. I mean in your life in general, in all things. And there's just no need for it. No one blames you for anything. No one even remembers it at this stage. I'm on the front page of a newspaper today, ma'am. Yes, well, if he had talked to me or your father before deciding to do this, to see him, we may have been able to help you make a better decision. A better? You just said. I pointed at her. That's blaming me, right there. You're doing it right now. Oh, Alison, that's not what. Look, I don't want to talk about this, okay? I moved towards the door that led to the hall. That's not why I came here. I'm looking for my photo albums. Where are they? Are they here? My mother said nothing for a long moment. I didn't like the look on her face, the hurt in it. I couldn't look at it. I looked away, out toward the back garden instead. Everything of yours is upstairs, she said then. The back bedroom. I went to leave the room. I'm done with this, Alison, she said. Just so you know. I stopped but didn't turn around. I'm done with pretending this didn't happen. With not talking about it. With not talking about anything that means something. I'm not going to let you do it anymore. We all need to change. I've already let this go on for way too long. And yes, it'll be hard and it'll hurt and you won't like it, but you're just going to have to suck it up and push through to the other side. She paused, took a breath, exhaled slowly. Now, are you hungry? I was going to have my lunch out, but I can go pick us up something. Any requests? I shook my head. Whatever you're having. Right so. Thanks. It's all right. I left the kitchen and went into the hall, climbed the stairs to the first floor landing. The door at the top of it looked to lead into a small, narrow bedroom that faced the back of the house. I made it inside and managed to close the door behind me. Just before I burst into tears. Alison then. Until I went to college, I'd never had a boyfriend. Liz and I were on the same page there, although for different reasons. She seemed wholly unimpressed with boys our age, rolling her eyes at what she saw as their pathetic attempts to impress us, and the desperate fumbling that ensued if they managed to. Meanwhile, I didn't know how to actually go about getting a boyfriend, or how anyone did. The meet-cutes of Hollywood movies, Ross and Rachel, the Sex and the City box set I'd snuck past my mother. What relevance did they have to a not-very-confident, all-girls secondary school student growing up in Cork? Even glossy magazines produced closer to home had features like 101 date moves guaranteed to get his attention, but no disclaimer that actually, this life may not apply to you, ever. Or maybe just not yet. For now, you were 17 and still lived with your parents, and so even though it felt like everything was running behind, it was actually all going to arrive right on schedule. Until then, I was left to worry about how I never found myself talking to nice guys in queues, or felt a spark as I brushed hands with someone else reaching for the last pair of gloves, or met some tall, dark, handsome stranger's eyes across a crowded room. But then, drunk and in a club, someone drunker tried to untie my top, and someone slightly less drunk came to my rescue. And just like that, Will and I had met. He was in St. John's too, studying law, but not sure he really wanted to. He was also living in halls. His parents lived in Dublin, but out on the coast, in a place he made sound very far away. That first night, we'd walked back to campus via Leeson Street, then down along the canal. When he kissed me goodnight in the shadow of Block A, it wasn't at all what I was expecting. He looked into my eyes, caressed my cheek with his hand, and then kissed me once, gently, slowly, deliberately, on the lips. And I thought, so that's what all the fuss is about. All the songs, they weren't about the desperate fumbles. They were about moments like this. He left me there, walking away into the night with a hand raised in a wave, and when I woke up the next morning with his name on my lips, I wasn't entirely sure I hadn't just dreamed the whole thing. It would be 5 days before I ran into him again, in a cafe in the village of Ranelagh, where I was hiding out. Liz, Claire and I had had more than a fair share of fun during Freshers' Week, but my energy stores for other people were depleted to a critical level, and I knew I needed some alone time before a second weekend's activities kicked off. I'd snuck out early and just kept walking, past Baggot Street, through leafy suburban streets, trying to keep the canal on my right, and my expanding virtual map in my head so that I wouldn't get completely lost. I'd happened upon a stretch of trendy cafes and restaurants with a village feel, and picked the one that had cushy armchairs visible through the front window. I was sitting there, curled up with the book I had a class on in the coming days, not draining the end of my coffee because I didn't want to leave, and I really couldn't afford to buy another one, when I heard my name, and I looked up, and he was there. "Well, this is weird," I said. He smiled. "And hello to you too." I closed my book. "You live in the next block to me, but I see you in here." "I saw you come in," he admitted. "In a non-stalker way. I was across the street." He pointed to his head. "Haircut." Now that he'd said it, it did look a bit less unruly than it had on Sunday night. "Nice," I said. "There isn't a place closer to campus?" "That put vouchers in the student union welcome packs for 50% off? No." "Ah, what are you doing this far from home?" "Hiding," I admitted. "It's been a long week." "You just needed some time off campus?" "And away from everybody, yeah." "Oh, okay then." He turned to go. "No," I rolled my eyes. "You know what I mean." A grin. "So I don't have to go?" "You don't have to go," I said. "No." "Here's an idea," he said. "Why don't we both go?" Will had a car with him, and as I sat into it, it occurred to me that this was exactly the kind of thing my mother had warned me not to do. No one knew where I was. No one knew who I was with. Even I didn't really know who I was with. I felt an undercurrent of nerves, and not just because I'd been daydreaming about him for the last 5 days straight, building a hymn out of the scant information I had. And now to be faced with the reality was both thrilling and terrifying. "Where are we going?" He shrugged.
"I was thinking the beach."
"Is there one near?"
"Sandymount."
"Where's that?"
"Close. You can actually walk there from St. John's."
I hadn't realized. All my Dublin fantasies took me from campus in the other direction into town. But here was a massive stretch of sand, extending so far out that the water's edge looked like it could be a mirage, an end of a rainbow you could start towards but might never reach. two enormous chimney stacks extended into the sky, on a peninsula on the north end, while off in the distance, on the southern tip of the bay, a cluster of buildings dominated by a church spire suggested a seaside town. Poolbeg and Dunleary, he told me. I think I came to look at a place near here, I said. I didn't even realize it was near a beach. Will looked at me.
You didn't want to be in halls.
I somehow ended up on their waiting list. We walked down onto the sand and then southwards, parallel to the shore.
You have to be careful here, Will said.
The tide comes in really fast. People are always getting stranded. It's lovely, though, I said.
Everywhere is lovely when the sun shines.
We'd covered all the basics on our walk back to campus in the early hours of Monday morning. Siblings, aspirations, likes, dislikes. Now, as we walked the beach, we talked about how we'd ended up in St. John's, why we'd chosen the courses we had, and what we planned on doing with our degrees once we had them. While he talked, I studied him, logging details in my mind for later daydreams. The fine hairs on his forearms, bleached white by the sun. How the knot of hair in the depression at the base of his neck was much darker. Blue-grey eyes. The wind picked up and he turned against it, letting it blow the thin cotton of his loose t-shirt against his skin, revealing sharp shoulder blades, a narrow waist. I longed to step forward and wrap my arms around him, and as if reading my thoughts, he reached out his hand and took mine, and then pulled me into him for a long, deep kiss. Right in the middle of the beach, where we had an audience of dog walkers and yummy mummies jogging in pairs. How can this be my life? I wondered. So much had changed in the space of a week. It seemed like I'd been waiting for years and years for something to happen, and now everything was. Changes coming as fast as falling dominoes, one after the other, with not enough time in between to make an individual sound. I was breathless and scared and exhilarated and certain, all at the same time. And then Will and I were rudely interrupted by a gust of wind that blew every strand of hair I had into the space between us. God, I said, pulling away.
Sorry, that's my fault. I thought beaches were supposed to be romantic.
Is that why you brought me here?
No, I just love the feel of sand in my shoes.
He smiled and dipped his head to kiss me again. We started back towards the car soon afterwards. On the way, I felt a buzz in my pocket, a text message from Liz. Where the hell are you? Claire and Liz were waiting for me outside our block. I said I'd walked as far as Ranelagh and left it at that. I just needed to get off campus for a couple of hours. Liz said she would have come with me. I woke up really early, I said. I didn't want to wake you. Jesus, Liz rolled her eyes. Do you think I spent half the day in bed or something? I realized I'd used the exact same excuse when I'd gone for coffee with Claire. We all had a library tour at 4 o'clock. The library was stuffy and hot, and the librarian taking us around spoke in a dreary monotone. After half an hour, Liz and I bailed. Claire said she'd stick it out, so we were down to 2 again. It hadn't been that way much this past week, and I wondered if that was partly why I felt so exhausted. It had been all new people all of the time, but Liz and I, alone together, was familiar and easy. Most of the time. I feel like I've barely talked to you all week, she said to me.
I know. It's been so busy.
Yeah.
And we're way behind on Lost.
I smiled. Priorities.
We could have skipped the library tour.
That would have been one episode, maybe 1.5.
What time is it?
Liz checked her watch.
We could squeeze one in now, maybe.
Liz suggested we go to her apartment, because her weird roommate was always out during the day. I wondered if this was really because she didn't want Claire coming back and joining us. And I wondered how she was going to react when I told her about Will. I did it just before we hit the play button. Liz, I said, I've something to tell you.
It better be about the guy you met on Sunday night.
What? You know?
Of course I know. Do you think you were wearing your invisibility cloak that night in the club? I saw you in him. He looked cute, actually. I've been waiting all week for you to tell me about him. So,
She put her hand under her chin in a theatrical show of intense interest. Who is he? What happened? Does he have any equally good-looking single friends? I rolled my eyes. All right, calm down. Tell me everything, Ali. Come on. So I did. And Liz wasn't bothered at all. She was delighted. She lapped up every detail. She made all the appropriate sounds. She was so enthusiastic. I felt bad that I'd thought badly of her. I shouldn't have. Alison, now. A minute, I gave myself. I let the tears flow, sank into my sadness, let it all in. Then I pulled some tissues from the box on the windowsill, wiped them away, and said, Okay, that's enough. That's it. The back bedroom turned out to be essentially a nicely decorated storage room. There was a single day bed pushed against one wall, facing a row of white built-in wardrobes with sliding doors. As I pushed them back, rows of opaque plastic boxes were revealed, neatly placed on the shelves inside and all labelled in my mother's handwriting. They were all filled with stuff of mine. The last compartment had no shelves, just a rail. A number of garments hung from those kind of quaint, stuffed hangers that have little bows on them and smell of floral things. After a second, I realized all the clothes were mine as well. A fall of black with a splash of diamante, encased now in a dust cover, the dress I'd worn to the freshers' ball. Thick, grey cable knit, the sweater I'd practically lived in during sixth year, because it was baggy and warm and comforting, and perfect for studying late at night in. Silvery silk shirt with a delicate floral print, the wraparound silk belt carefully detached, smoothed out and tied neatly around the hanger. What I'd been wearing the night I'd first met Will. It had been Liz's originally. I'd loved that shirt so much, loved how I'd looked in it. It had probably been the first item of clothing I'd owned that wasn't from some disposable fashion store, that needed to be treated delicately, that won compliments whenever I put it on. I fingered the silk, trying to remember being the girl who'd worn such a beautiful thing, who'd wanted people to turn and look at her, who felt good when they did. What would she be doing now if things had been different? Who would she be? I took the grey sweater off the hanger, pulled it on over my pajama top. It smelled faintly of lavender, which I guessed was the hanger's fault. It wasn't quite as billowing on me as it had once been, but it still felt like a security blanket. Bracing myself, I turned to the boxes. I had no idea what I was about to find. When Will had been arrested, my parents had come to collect me from Halls and take me back home with them to Cork. 2 days later, I was on a flight to the Netherlands with only the bag I'd packed in a rush 2 days before. It was in the weeks after that my mother had gone back to St. John's and cleared out all the stuff I'd left behind. I think she thought I'd be back soon, that I might even pick up college somewhere else in Ireland come September. I already knew I was never coming back. Let's start with something easy. I pulled out the box marked books and sat it on the floor. The contents comprised entirely of the texts on the English Lit first-year reading list. The Riverside Chaucer, Shakespeare, The Complete Works, Literary Theory, An Introduction. All hefty, expensive tomes. Their smooth, unblemished spines and the clean gloss of their covers were a reminder that I'd been a terrible student, distracted by all the shiny bits of the college experience that had nothing to do with being educated. The heady rush of being away from home for the first time, the endless adventure that living in a city like Dublin offered, Will and his eyes and his arms and his touch. I replaced the lid and pushed the box to one side. Next up, desk. Did this mean the stuff that I'd kept in my desk in Halls? Lifting the lid, I saw a clear plastic wallet with my proof of college registration and college ID inside it. So yes, this was the contents of my 3 junk drawers, which my mother had evidently organized and neatly stored. There was a lilac envelope thick with ticket stubs that, as far as I remembered, had been tacked to a notice board in my room. I saw her in my mind's eye, carefully unpinning each one. Two grubby, yellowing refill pads were held together with an elastic band. I had a flashback of bringing them into lectures, and then only doodling nonsense across their pages, while the lecturer droned on. I worked my way through various folders, a St. John's prospectus, little trinkets and mementos I'd collected along the way, and got to the bottom of the box without finding a single thing connected to Will. No cards, no pictures, no CD or borrowed notes. Had I thrown them away, or had she? I hadn't had time to. I scanned the remaining boxes, but nothing was marked as obviously as Will. My mother hadn't been merely organizing my stuff. She'd been editing it, too. I pulled down a box marked photo albums. I took a deep breath before I removed the lid, and then laughed at what was sitting on top of the stack of albums inside, as if waiting for me all this time. The brick. It wasn't even 15 years old, but the world had such a ferocious appetite for new tech, and the tech companies were in such a rush to satisfy it, that the camera looked now like a relic from a bygone era, a prop from a space-age show that envisioned a future of jetpacks and teleporting, a future that had never transpired. It was about the size of a half-dozen egg carton, and just as clunky. Sharp corners, thick buttons, sliding switches, and a matchbox-sized screen. Its dull grey case was heavily scratched, and the strap was missing. I pressed the on button, but nothing happened. The batteries inside long dead. I smiled at the idea that I'd once thought I was the height of sophistication with that thing, lugging my little brick around, carrying it in my bag on nights out. In my defense, our phones were just about taking blurry pics back then, and we couldn't do much with them except send them to each other. I set the camera carefully on the floor and started on the photo albums. I couldn't put them off anymore. The first album was nearly all shots of campus in the snow. I'd got the camera at Christmas, and when we'd returned to St. John's in January, there'd been one day, just for a few hours very early in the morning, when the entire place was blanketed in white, fluffy snow. Most of the shots were of me and Will. Liz must have taken them. I imagined her, holding the camera in front of her face, looking at the little screen. I wondered what she'd been thinking at the time. Thinking about her now, I felt a stab of pain. I tried not to linger, but I didn't go quite quickly enough to stop myself from falling into some of those memories, marveling at this 19-year-old version of me, who seemingly knew how to have more of a life than this 29-year-old one. I was smiling in every picture, my eyes sparkling. In many of them, a hand or a fall of hair would be blurred, because I'd been moving, unable to stay still even for one moment. I looked so alive. I didn't like getting my photo taken now. I didn't like the dark possibility of where the images might one day end up. I stopped at a picture of Liz and me, stood in evening dresses the night of the traffic light ball. They were our Deb's dresses. We just swapped them over for the occasion, so we'd each have something new to wear. Liz's floor-length, fishtail black strapless dress looked different on me than it had on her. The material stretched across the small swell of my stomach, the corset part of it pinching the skin under my arms. She'd told me I'd look beautiful in it. I looked at Liz, her wide smile, thought about what was coming towards her, hurtling towards her, and none of us knew it. The picture blurred. I turned the page. Overleaf was one of Will, sitting on my bed with his phone in one hand, a Motorola Razr, all the rage back then, and looking into the lens with a question on his face, as if I'd just called his name and caught him by surprise. He was wearing a navy sweatshirt I remembered well, whose material I could feel now, well-worn and thick, soft against my face. I could almost remember the smell of it, of him. In the picture, there was a half-smile on his lips, as if whatever I could want from him, whatever request I had of him, he'd be willing to give. Because he was kind. Because he was a good person. Because when I pressed my hand to his chest to feel his heart beating, he'd look down at me and say, "That's all for you." And it didn't feel cheesy or fake, but real and incredible, and I wanted to feel it again, just for one second. I didn't believe I would ever feel it again. Couldn't with anyone else. I'd give back the whole of my first year in St. John's, those 9 months with him, just for one more moment with him now, because I missed him. I missed that. I missed us. I loved him and I missed me, the old me. I wanted to be with him and I wanted to be her again. But he'd killed the girl on the previous page, and in other ways, he'd killed the girl I was supposed to become. I was crying again, salty tears dropping down my cheeks, the taste of them on my lips. The truth was, I'd never stopped loving Will. I just accepted that the Will I'd known and loved was dead. 10 years later, I was still trying to come to terms with the fact that he'd never really existed in the first place. I looked at the caption on the photo. 28th of January, 2007. If Will was guilty, then the boy in this photo, the kind, good boy who'd loved me, had, at that very moment, already ended a life and had successfully, totally, hidden all traces of his dark secret from me. And was planning his next. Was that even possible? Yes, okay, it was possible. Psychopaths were skilled in such deceptions, because entire personalities could be performances, a costume of humanity easily put on or taken off. I'd watched enough TV to know that. But was it likely? I thought back to him in that buttery yellow room, pleading with me, pleading his case, wishing he could show me what was in his head, so that he could prove to me that he was telling the truth. Just as an experiment, I tried it on. The idea that Will was innocent. It took some effort. Will would have to have been incredibly susceptible to coercion if that confession was false, and caught the eye of the country's most prolific serial killer just at the moment he was looking for someone to frame. And then Will would have had to lack the sufficient motivation to do anything about it for nearly 10 years. But I imagined it anyway. Just for a second, because that was all I could stand. Because it instantly brought everything crashing down. What I'd done then. What I hadn't done since then. The promise that was Will and me, broken for no reason at all. Liz killed by a stranger. Even more terrifying than what I'd imagined in the dark corners of my mind these past 10 years. If Will really was innocent, it felt like I might lose everything. Like the ground would shift and tilt, and everything I had would slide away and fall off. So he couldn't be. Anyway, he wasn't innocent. There was too much evidence against him. Evidence I couldn't ignore. Behavior I couldn't get past. Coincidences too improbable.